This is Michael Cowan, and welcome to Trial Lawyer Nation.
You are the leader in the courtroom, and you want the jury to be looking to you for the answers.
When you figure out your theory, never deviate.
You want the facts to be consistent, complete, and credible.
The defense has no problem running out the clock. Delay is the friend of the defense.
It's tough to grow a firm by trying to hold on and micromanage.
You've got to front load a simple structure for jurors to be able to hold on to.
What types of creative things can we do as lawyers, even though we don't have a trial setting?
Whatever you've got to do to make it real, you've got to do to make it real. But the person who needs convincing is you.
Welcome to the award-winning podcast, Trial Lawyer Nation. Your source to win bigger verdicts, get more cases, and manage your law firm. And now, here's your host, noteworthy author, sought-after speaker, and renowned trial lawyer, Michael Cowan.
We're going to start a new feature on this podcast. It's Ask Michael and Mallory Anything. If you have anything you'd like to ask either Mallory or me, we're going to start doing an episode every couple months where we're going to answer your questions. So just send them in to me at michael@cowanlaw.com, and Mallory and I will answer them. Anything from, you know, legal strategy, marketing management, anything else in life you want to talk about, we'll be glad to talk about it with you. Again, ask Michael and Mallory Anything. Just send us an email. We'll be glad to answer your questions. Today on Trial Lawyer Nation, we have a great attorney out of Dallas, Texas, Todd Tracy. Todd, how are you doing today?
Well, I'm doing well. How are you, Michael?
I'm doing great. Todd, you are probably one of the kings of automotive product liability cases, and thank you so much for coming on. I know one thing I really want to cover today are the types of cases we should be looking for and that, you know, lawyers often miss. But before we get into that, I want to talk a little bit about who you are. So tell us a little bit about your background.
Sure. I have a degree in applied physics. I've been a lawyer for 38 years, and for the first 5 years of my practice, I was at Jones Day defending Ford and Mazda, and realized really quickly that I was on the wrong side. I needed to be on the plaintiff's side. So went over to Wendell Turley's office, spent 5 years there, and then started my own law firm. And my law firm now is a nationwide practice where we focus on vehicle crashworthiness cases or vehicle defect cases.
That is a really specialized area. Other than, you know, doing some of the work you did on the defense side, what did you do to gain the knowledge needed to identify and then litigate a vehicle defect case?
Well, the one thing that I, you know, that I utilized when I first started on the plaintiff side is I asked a lot of questions to a lot of great lawyers, and I was amazed at the open door policy that they had. And they welcomed me into their offices. They taught me the ins and the outs of this. Wendell, obviously, was one of the pioneers of crashworthiness. And then I have taken that philosophy on myself, and I've always believed in no matter what I do on a case, if you want my entire trial transcript, if you want my entire outlines, if you want all the testing we've done, I always give it up. I have never shied away from sharing this information with people because that's how I started out, and I'm going to make certain that I teach the next generation of crashworthiness lawyers what I know.
And I can attest to that because, oh gosh, it may be 6 or 7 years ago now, I'm dating myself, but Mallory Peacock and I were trying a case, and there was a defense expert that was going to be on the stand, and you had crossed that defense expert before. And you not only gave me an outline that you used in a trial that you won, but your outline had very specific pages and lines from prior depositions he gave where he was locked into certain things, and then you gave me the depositions. So you made it so easy for me to look like a really good lawyer in that courtroom.
Well, I tell you, the one thing I did learn at Jones Day is you've got to learn to grind it out. And then I learned as a plaintiff lawyer, if you're not willing to, burn the midnight oil, and I'm talking, you know, when you're waking up at 3 and 4 o'clock in the morning, getting 2 or 3 hours of sleep for 2 or 3 months at a time, I believe that's what it takes to be a great lawyer. I know that you do that as in your trucking cases. And I think we have to, I think we owe it to our clients. We can sleep when we're dead.
Yeah.
Right now we need to be working hard.
You're not only working hard, though, you're sharing the results of your labor with other lawyers on their cases.
It's critically important that we share, and because our firm has had some level or measure of success, we do a lot of crash testing, and the crash testing can cost a lot of money. And we always give our crash test up to organizations or anyone who, in fact, we put them on our website so that anybody can have all the crash testing they need to develop one of their own cases.
That is so incredible, especially knowing, having done these kind of cases, the incredible costs that you put in there. Yeah, it's interesting. When I talk to lawyers that are outside of the law and discuss sharing, they're just, not just lawyers, but other people in corporate America I went to high school with or college with, and they're always like, well, how can you give away your IP? Well, how much money do they pay you to get that test that you ran? I'm like, well, I already got paid for it when I resolved the case, so why would I charge them anything?
Well, and it's important that we help out our brethren, because if they are successful, then it's going to help us out, because the worst thing that we can have happen when we're at mediation is somebody said, well, you know, Joe Smith just lost a trial on this, you know, on this identical issue here. So yeah, Therefore your value is going to go down today. Well, if I've been able to help Joe Smith out by giving him some outlines or cross-examination ideas or crash testing that enables him to achieve success, it's going to benefit me in the long run as well.
So what is it about automotive defect cases that drove you to focus in that area?
Well, when I was in law school, I had my wife was killed.
Oh, no, I'm sorry.
So I realized that I wanted to look at why that happened. And, you know, I didn't think that going to the plaintiff's side would benefit me the most. So that's why I started at Jones Day. But ultimately, I realized that if I'm going to be able to ever answer other questions on young men or young women or families who have lost a loved one, I'm going to have to understand the ins and outs and the nuances of vehicle safety. And that was really my motivating factor.
Why do you think, you know, after all these decades of litigation, why do you think we still have manufacturers making decisions that lead to deaths, injuries, and litigation?
Well, I hate to say, but I have seen documents recently from Mazda, and they specifically stated why they were not enacting safer alternative designs here in the United States, because the Trump administration was coming back into office, and they said when he was in office for his first term, he said that was the best thing that ever happened to the manufacturers, because he cut the budget for the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. And they were not pursuing zealously any type of safety efforts. And if you look historically at, you know, at safety regulations, we have regulations that were in existence and were written initially 18 months before we walked on the moon.
Wow.
And they have never been revised. The seat that we sit in our vehicles have never been revised, and they were adopted 18 months before Neil Armstrong walked on the moon, if that gives you an idea how old they are.
Yeah, that is insane when you think of the advances we've had in technology since then.
Well, and I have seen documents from Chrysler where it said, all we're going to do is follow the pack. Don't be leaders, be followers. I just cannot imagine any corporation in America saying, let's not be the leaders in anything. It's just beyond me. But I see documents like that all the time.
Yeah, they put, you know, half the effort into safety they put into marketing, we probably would be out of business.
Well, remember this. Engineers know how to, you know, these engineers that work at these companies, they're smart. They know how to do it. The problem that we have and why we don't have safety is because Wall Street dictates what these manufacturers can do, because they're concerned about the next quarter or the quarter after that. And if they don't reach their quarter mark, then they're worried about getting fired. They're worried about a shareholder derivative lawsuit. Whereas if they let the engineers make engineering decisions and kept the, you know, the Wharton School of Business guys out of the equation, we wouldn't have any problems.
You know, I want to kind of break the next part of our discussion into two parts. So the first part I want to talk about, and this is really for the 95 to 98% of us that aren't going to do our own classroom in this cases, you know, what kind of cases we should look at, because I know that there are so many cases missed and so many plaintiffs that don't get full compensation because we don't know what we don't know. We don't know what issues we're looking for. Then the second part after we talk about those is to talk a little deeper. If someone wants to do one of these cases, you know, what all is involved and what they would have to do to learn and, you know, the effort and cost involved in doing one. So let's start with the first part. What are some of the cases, you know, right now in 2025 that are, I guess, hot that we should be looking for?
Well, if I were to have a top five list, I would say number one, front seats that collapse backwards in a rear impact. You have to remember, in a rear impact, the body goes backwards. Well, your primary restraint system is the seat. If the seat collapses backwards, it doesn't matter if you have your seat belt on or not. You're going to get thrown into the back seat. And if you have a child sitting behind you, you're going to crush your child and or you're going to crush your head up against them. That's number one. Number two, they are called lack of center mounted airbags. So if you are involved in a T-bone accident, meaning you are hit perfectly in the side and you are on the far side of that impact, the way the seat belts are designed, you will roll out of your seat belt and you will literally strike the occupant sitting next to you, or you will strike the intruding structure, such as the door. These center-mounted airbags have been available since 1999, and they're still only used in four vehicles here in the United States. Number three, this phenomena called submarining, either on the front seat or in the rear seat. Submarining basically means this. Your body, your lower body, and the lat belt slides up into the soft intra-abdominal walls of the abdomen. Because there, as you begin to slide forward, the seat belt slides over these hard bones of the, called the iliac crest. When that happens, that lat belt literally slices through your abdomen, goes all the way back to your lumbar spine. But more importantly, as you do this, you literally slide down. And when it does that, the geometry of the shoulder belt changes, and you can literally decapitate yourself. Big, and these are problems. And in the rear, this is what's really sad about the rear. The Insurance Institute for Highway Safety 3 years ago said, we are facing an epidemic of death to children in the rear seat because the seats do not take care of them. Number four, we still have a lot of roof crush cases, but not because of rollovers, but because objects striking the front portion of the roof called the header. You know, we see animal strikes in all sorts of states around the country, and it can be horse, cow, moose, deer. It can be objects that are flying off of a trailer, and it literally just rips the roof off and causes unbelievable death and destruction. And then the fifth kind of case is on these third row seated vehicles that are the smaller SUVs with three rows or the mid-size SUVs with third row. We did a series of tests because the NHTSA and no car manufacturer had ever done a crash test with each of the three rows of occupants seated with an instrumented crash test dummy. And when we hit them, it would have killed anyone in the vehicle in the rear seat. And the damage was so great, those dummies literally crushed the second row occupants.
Wow.
I gave those tests to the government and to all the vehicle manufacturers in April. And I said, since you guys didn't care enough to do the testing, I did it for you. Now, you need to go fix it.
So I want to go a little bit into each of these five types so we know what to look for. So let's start with the seat back case. And that's basically the seat's not robust enough. Are those rear impact cases typically?
They are always rear impact cases. When the front seat collapses backwards, it's always a rear impact case. And what we're looking for there is if you have a major cervical spine injury or a serious head injury, and you can even be thrown out of your vehicle completely with the seatbelt on, or you're going to crush someone in the back. If you have one of those cases and your seat is laying flat almost or laying back up against the rear seat, you need to keep the car and you need to work it up right, or you need to find somebody that knows how to work them up and work with them. That's the first thing you do on a seat back case.
Yeah, so I think those are especially powerful. I mean, obviously the person in the seat back getting hurt, that those are good cases. But when you put your child in the back seat, especially in a booster seat or a child safety seat, like they tell you to, and then you end up, because your seat back is so weak, that your head kills your child or your head paralyzes your child or brain damages your own child because of their design decision. And those are, I think, really important cases to bring.
Well, they're horrible cases because the guilt factor to the parent who was doing nothing wrong other than they bought a vehicle who they had no idea whose seat was too weak. And by when we're talking too weak, we're talking the standard that governs seats is a standard called FMVSS 207, and it talks about rear inch pound moments. Well, to give you an idea how weak the standard is, we have done testing with a Walmart lawn chair, and we built a chair out of cardboard boxes that we bought from those moving van boxes from U-Haul, and we built a seat, and we passed the standard. Because it is so unbelievably weak and ineffective.
You know, two things from back in the day when I did those cases, I would just tell people, you know, if you've got, you know, a spinal cord injury, you know, paraplegia, quadriplegia of somebody in the front seat, you have some evidence that the kid in the back seat got hit, or you have a death, or you have a, you know, someone wearing their seatbelt and they got ejected. Even if when you go look at the vehicle, the seat's not all the way back at the time, it may have been bent back and then someone adjusted it to get someone out.
Absolutely.
There's something, you know, there's some kind of spring back where it can go back and then kind of bounce forward a little bit. So, you know, if you have those kind of injuries or death, getting someone to go x-ray that seat and seeing if there's deformation is probably worth doing when you have that kind of injury.
Absolutely. And what you're talking about is, dynamic deformation versus versus plastic deformation, where it does spring back, and they spring back upwards of 20%, and people do, seats do get moved, especially if they are a manual recline mechanism. But we can tell real quickly where the seat was positioned by looking. You know, we literally take the fabric and the foam off the seats. It's called a D-trim. We do an autopsy of the seat, and we can tell you exactly where it was positioned before the impact and after the impact. And, I never worry about where it's positioned, after the EMTs leave. They have their job to do. I have mine.
And so for the rest of us, the big thing is just when you have that kind of injury, preserve the vehicle and get someone that knows what they're doing looking at it, whether it's a lawyer, whether it's an expert, someone that can figure that out. And then don't start taking the seat apart without properly notifying the other side.
You definitely want to make certain that you got a lawsuit going on and that you invite all of the players there. And by the players, I mean the vehicle manufacturer as well as the seat supplier. I mean, because a lot of times, my first 25 years of my practice, I never really sued the seat supplier. Then we realized that the seat suppliers, they are now designing the seats. The car manufacturers really don't design anything anymore. They go out to the suppliers, and they're the ones that do the engineering analysis, the design, and the development. So the seat supplier is just as viable, if not more viable, defendant than the OEM manufacturer.
And OEM is like the original equipment, like Ford, General Motors?
Ford, GM, Toyota, yes. And then your suppliers are, your Lear, your JCI, your Adient, Kuiper, Recaro.
And why is it so important to make sure that we preserve, whenever we have a death or catastrophic injury, that we preserve the vehicle?
Well, that is the most critical piece of evidence, because it tells you everything you need to do to prove design defect and causation and eliminate all of the BS defenses, because the manufacturers have a whole playbook of defenses that they like to use. They'll try to sit there and say, well, they weren't wearing their seatbelt. You can prove that by having the vehicle. Well, they had the seatbelt behind their back. You can prove that by having the vehicle. They had the belt under their arm. You can tell that. They already had the seat reclined. You can tell that. But you've got to have the vehicle in a crashworthiness case is the same thing as the human body is to a pathologist in a criminal case.
Yeah, so important. I think so many cases are lost because people don't act quick enough, and you know, they settle the property damage claim. The insurance company takes the vehicle, sells it for parts, scraps it, and then, you know, occasionally we can go track it down, but a lot of times it's just gone and the case died with it.
And I always love when they say, "But we have 50 photographs. Isn't that enough?" I bet you on these cases we average, you know, between both sides, I bet there's 5,000 photographs taken, and we may show 10 to a jury.
And the most important thing, like you said, on those seatback cases is until you take things you can't photograph, until you take off the padding, take off the cover and look at the metal underneath and how it ended up, you don't know. And so, you know, even, you know, whether you x-ray it, whether you actually detrim it and take everything off, you can't tell that from just a photograph taken from the outside.
No, you can't. And when you mentioned x-ray earlier, God, I remember 25 years ago, we used to have the mobile x-ray machine come out to our warehouse and they would x-ray it. I was so glad when we finally came up with a better mousetrap, and that was, why do we need to x-ray it when we can, I don't know, just remove the foam and the fabric?
Well, like I said, I'm dating myself because it's been a while since I decided to focus on trucking and not do as many of these. Although it's on the seatbacks, it is tempting because those are such great cases.
They really are.
I want to go down to the second type of case, the lack of a center-mounted airbag. So you're talking about you have a T-bone collision, what you call a far-sighted occupant. So if the T-bone's onto the passenger side, you're talking about someone on the driver's side.
That's right. So you're on the far side. And the way the shoulder belt is routed, you literally roll out of your seatbelt if you go forward one side or the other, depending on where you're sitting. The problem that you have here is once you roll out, then you are free to impact the occupant next to you, to impact the steering wheel if you're going toward the driver's side, to impact the side of the seat, or if the intrusion from whatever is impacting you pushes the door inwards, you know, 18 inches or so, you're going to strike that. The way the center-mounted bag works is that there is an airbag that comes out of the seat and prevents you from rolling out. Now, what's weird here is that General Motors was the first vehicle manufacturer in the United States to use this back in 2013. And for years, everybody thought that was the gold standard. And then we realized, God, this is the dinkiest, smallest airbag we've ever seen. And then, believe it or not, Mazda made a vehicle that they built for Toyota called the Toyota Yaris. Mm-hmm. And that vehicle has two airbags that come out of the driver's seat and two airbags that come out of the passenger seat. So no matter what principal direction of force, your body's going to go. And no matter how the seats are positioned, you're going to hit an airbag and you're going to stay in the safe confines of your seat. And that is the whole principle behind crashworthiness is we want to keep you upright in a nominally seated position so that your safety systems can do their jobs.
And that's incredible. It's a Yaris, too. That's not exactly an expensive vehicle.
It is not. I mean, so it's shocking. And we did not realize that when we tore down, we brought over four Yarises recently from Europe. When we started tearing them down, we realized, my God, this isn't a Toyota. We did not realize that it was a Mazda. Every part we took off the vehicle was a Mazda. And so we just sent some discovery out and said, who manufactured this thing? Oh, this is a Mazda-Toyota joint venture. We were shocked, frankly, that Toyota would actually team up with Mazda.
So you've got the T-bone impact. What type of injuries are we looking for when we're screening for these cases?
You're typically going to have a brain injury, or you're going to have a serious, serious lower lumbar injury. Because if you roll out of your seatbelt, you were really cranking over onto your oblique side, and you were going to break your spine. And so you're either going to have head injuries that are typically catastrophic, or you're going to have paralysis, usually at the L2, L3, L4 level, because you got to remember you were rolling out and rolling around your buckle. So the buckle is a fulcrum point that causes you to hyperflex around your buckle, but you're going in a sideways direction rather than a fore and aft direction.
Okay, and those submarining cases,
are those
frontal or rear impacts or both? What kind of impacts are those?
We see submarining injuries typically in frontal impacts because your body is going forward and you need to have a series of countermeasures to stop. Now, the car manufacturers have known about submarining since the 1960s, and they have been trying to come up with countermeasures to stop this submarining. For example, you may remember back in the 90s, there were these things called knee airbags. Everybody thought that the knee airbags were designed to protect the lower limbs, you know, from your kneecap down to your ankle. That's not what the purpose of them happened to be. They were designed to control the forward kinematics, the movement of the body, so that your lap belt wouldn't slide over your iliac crest. They then they stopped doing those, and they put these pretensioners on seat belts, meaning it was a device that really snugged down tightly. Usually it was on the retractor, that thing that goes in and out on the shoulder belt side, and they also put it on the buckle. So we had two different kinds of pretensioners for a while, and it really tied you to the seat nicely. The most recent thing, you're going to love this one. They put an airbag in the seat cushion, and the airbag fires, and it looks like a saddle horn on a saddle. And so as you begin to slide forward, you impact this seat cushion, and you stop going forward, and it has eliminated submarining. Here's the weird deal about this. The car manufacturers don't advertise the fact that the seat cushion airbag even exists. It's the only airbag in a vehicle that does not have yellow wiring. Every other airbag has to have yellow wiring for the first responders, so that when they're coming up there, they know where the airbags are, so they can cut the airbag wire so that they won't have an accidental deployment. Also, when a seat cushion airbag fires, it doesn't tear the fabric, so you can't tell that there was a seat cushion airbag to begin with. So when you take it in to get repaired, they don't know to repair anything because there's never any indication that there's a seat cushion airbag.
Oh my God.
But these cars are on Toyotas, Subarus, Hyundais, cars that you wouldn't expect it. And they're now starting to slide them into the rear seats because submarining is such an epidemic.
So what kind of injuries are we looking for on the submarining cases?
You're going to have one of three injuries, Michael. You're going to have major intra-abdominal injuries. I mean, I'm talking where you totally rip apart your mesentery, your bowels, your intestines. You're going to get serious cervical spine injuries because you're literally going to hang yourself on the shoulder belt. As your lower body slides under the lap belt, that's going to change the way the seat belt is routed. So instead of riding on your clavicle and your sternum, you're going to slide, your body slides down, and it slides off of the clavicle into your neck. And so you're going to get a C1, C2 atlanto-occipital joint disruption, also known as a hangman's fracture. The third type of injury you're going to get is you're going to get a carotid artery injury that's going to cause you to have strokes or brain damage because of that momentary closing of the artery. These are they're horrible cases. I've had people where they were literally decapitated because of sliding under the belt, and the lap belt, you know, caught their neck and literally decapitated them.
Fourth type of case, you said roof crush from objects like animals or things falling off of trucks hitting the header. I guess that's between the two pillars, like right above where your windshield is.
That's basically the top of your windshield is this big structure that's the header. Now, you got to remember, we've been fighting roof crush cases for decades. I guarantee you probably handled some, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, and we always fought the same thing, and that we fought this phenomena called the diving injury. It's not the roof crush that causes injury. It's the occupant diving into the crushing roof. The beautiful thing about these roof crush cases without a rollover, there is no diving defense because the occupant that's restrained in there, all that happens is that roof crush comes in and conks them right on the head, causing massive brain injury, causing massive cervical spine injury or asphyxia. If that header comes down and crushes the A-pillar, it's going to take your head and your head-neck complex is going to go down to your sternum. It's going to prevent you from taking full breaths, and you literally asphyxiate. You cannot breathe, and it's like drowning on land. It's a horrible death. It's slow, and it's painful, and you know you're dying.
Yeah, this is morbid stuff to talk about, but for what we're looking for in cases, so we're looking for the positional asphyxia. You're crushed, you can't breathe, and you die that way. You're looking for also death or catastrophic injury caused by brain injury or a neck, cervical, spine injury.
That's correct. I mean, and you're right. These are gruesome cases. And I would encourage your audience, if you have a case, and you mentioned it earlier, if you have a case where your client has not been able to achieve a full measure of justice because they didn't have, there wasn't a lot of insurance available. There was no insurance available because let's say it was a single vehicle accident and your client didn't have insurance. Well, and your client's paralyzed or catastrophically brain damaged. You have to do, as a lawyer, we have an obligation to try to help them. Now, I will tell you, there's a lot of lawyers that won't do that. They're not going to go the extra mile. We need to do better. And by doing better, if our clients haven't achieved full measure of recovery, find a way to get to a recovery. Crashworthiness is one of them. If not everybody's lucky enough to hit a Pepsi Cola truck, so sometimes you've got to start looking downstream. Look at the car. How did the car work? Did the safety systems work? The vehicle that struck them, did it have all the safety systems in place to prevent that car from coming over? Where was that driver coming from? Had they been drinking? Maybe there's a dram shop case. We owe it to our clients to do a full legal analysis of potential liability.
And the nice thing is for those of us who, I used to do these cases and I'm not doing them anymore just because of the amount of time. I can't run a law firm, supervise other people, and then be the, Mallory and I are the only ones that really at our firm have had any experience doing crashworthiness. It is just very, very lawyer intense, but I don't have to because all I have to do is preserve the vehicle and get someone that knows what they're doing, and they can come and spend the money to look at to see whether I have a case or not. And so it's not really any risk on my part other than maybe splitting the fee on that $30,000 policy, which isn't going to make a difference.
In fact, we always tell people, whatever you do, depending on our jurisdiction, we try to encourage people, do not settle with that underlying defendant, because sometimes we would prefer to be in state court. Sometimes we would prefer to be in federal court. Sometimes we stay away from federal court only because it's a judge that we know for a fact is never going to allow us to try the case, that they are going to kill us with 1,000 paper cuts, but we're going to spend $200,000 or $300,000 only to have our experts stricken. Only to never really get to the jury. And that's sad, but that's the state of affairs that we currently live in certain states in this country.
And it depends on the defect, but we've done some focus groups recently on a automotive product liability case, and we've kind of done split testing. We've presented it different ways. And when we presented it as if we had already settled with the driver and company that employed the driver, they were looking more like we were trying to cash in on a deep pocket. But when we had everybody in the case saying, look, the driver messed up and they're here to take responsibility, but it's not fair to 100% blame the driver when there's other factors. They were so much more receptive to the case with the driver still in the case.
Yeah, I'm getting ready to try a case in September, that identical scenario, and it's amazing how that defendant can be your biggest cheerleader.
Yep.
I mean, you're not focusing on them, but I tell you what they can do is they say, hey, my guy admitted his fault because that's the way he was raised. I don't know why this company over here isn't doing it. That's powerful.
It is. And having an empty chair is also powerful when you have someone that can dump on the defendant and there's no one defending the defendant. It just is so much more powerful when you have everybody there.
Well, because I will tell you, you want to use the empty chair against them because they're not going to have a corporate rep sitting there. They may have a corporate rep. The vast majority of times on the trials that I've had, they do not have one. So I will call whoever's sitting at counsel table. If it's a lawyer that they've introduced as a lawyer, I said, I want him to testify. Well, Judge, he's a lawyer. They were introduced as the representative for the company. I want them. Call them right off the bat, scares the crap out of them, and it lets the jury know this guy is serious. He is not afraid to ask questions that he doesn't know the answer to because he doesn't even know this dude's name.
Yep.
It's powerful.
Absolutely. Okay, the fifth type, your third row occupants in the smaller mid-sized SUVs. Can you just tell me a little bit about that is and what we're looking for?
Okay. I want you to, if you ever get an opportunity to get one of these vehicles, I don't know if you drive one or go rent one, and you put an occupant in the back seat and you envision a pickup truck hitting your vehicle at 55 miles an hour. And the reason I say that is because that's what the standard says. The standard is a 55 mile an hour rear impact into a stationary object. When you hit a third row vehicle that have occupants in there, they literally, I had to pay $58,000 in damages to the crash test dummies, and they're made of titanium.
Wow.
They broke off the arms and the legs and bent the spines on titanium crash test dummies. It also then, so they're going backwards initially, then they start going forward. And it takes that seat and it's like a domino effect. You've got the bumper, you've got the seat, you've got the crash test dummy, then slamming into the back of the second row seats, which then injures them. When the car manufacturers do their testing, they put crash test dummies in the front seats only. They don't do crash testing with a full occupant load in every seating position. The NHTSA, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, has never required it. That is a monumental mistake on their part. The Insurance Institute for Highway Safety has never run a test like that. We use CalSpan, which is the largest testing facility in the world. They had never done one. When we did these three, they all went home that night and they called me the next day and they said, I want to thank you because we are never putting our children in that third row again. And that's the theory, Mike. Do not, if you've got a third row vehicle and you don't have 4 feet of crush space, then you do not use it. That's the theory.
That's insane because they tell us to put our kids back there and then they never even test it. Our kids are the freaking crash test dummies.
Our children become the crash test dummies in real world events. And I don't know about you, that's punitive damages kind of stuff there because it's shocking, it's reckless, and it's, hell, I think it's tantamount to murder.
And so what kind of, and this is morbid again, but what kind of injuries and causes of death are we looking for the people in the second and third row?
You're going to get massive orthopedic crush injuries. And I'm talking crush from literally the base of the skull all the way down to your sacrum, to your L5 level of your lumbar spine, everything in between there. Then once you get, you crush them up against the back of the second row seats, then you start crushing all the ribs. And if you start crushing the ribs, then you're going to get lacerations of internal organs. Cause that's what, you know, fractures to ribs, they cause lacerations and tears to the lungs, the spleen, the diaphragm, the liver, the kidneys, and you bleed out. And we have three cases like this right now, and the car manufacturers, they don't know how to defend it because they don't have testing, and there's only been three tests ever done, and I did them, and they just, you know, they just throw their hands up, and they know when they focus group it that they're going to get crucified.
So we've talked about how to spot, you know, what I'd call the five hottest or, you know, five most common that we should be looking for types of crashworthiness in this case. But in general, I'd say anytime you have a death or a catastrophic injury, like someone in a spinal cord, someone in a wheelchair, or somebody with a brain injury that was noticed by the ER that has a substantial obvious effect on them, not one that you have to go send them to neuropsych testing to identify because it's a more mild, not that those aren't life-changing, but those are harder to do on a product basis. I think you still should have someone look at it because there are other angles. We can't talk about every possible angle here.
Absolutely. You know, I mean, and I always tell this. If your client is not has not been taken care of for the balance of their life, and I'm talking in a comfortable level, and other people were in the same vehicle and they were not injured, and then you've got one person that was catastrophically injured, you need to start asking some questions why.
Absolutely.
You gotta remember, your cases on the trucking companies, those are negligence cases, so they focus on who caused the injury, who caused the accident and the injury. The kind of cases that I focus on are what caused the injuries. And I always look at it like this. There is an absolute distinction between the cause of an accident versus the cause of an injury. And I say the best example of that happened on April 15th, 1911, when the Titanic went down. When the Titanic hit that iceberg, not a single person suffered a bruise, a contusion, a cut, a broken bone. Yet 3.5 hours later, 2,917 people were dead. Why? Because there weren't enough lifeboats on board to provide safety for everyone on board with some measure of, you know, a statistical amount of people there that we factor out. We're going to have 10% greater. That is what crashworthiness is all about. How did our safety systems perform? Did the safety systems perform as a system, or did the system fail somewhere? It's like links in a chain. If you've got 100 links in a chain, if 99 links work perfectly and the 100th doesn't work very well, it doesn't matter because that safety chain is going to fail.
So I want to go to the kind of the second part, which is we've talked about the cases to look for. If someone wants to do their own crashworthiness in this case, what are kind of like the basic things that need to be done?
First thing you have to do, obviously, you tie the vehicle up, and then you get all the medical records because you have got to tie down causation. Causation, as you now know in your trucking cases, causation and foreseeability are such a monument. They're monumentally important in the trucking world. They're equally important in my world. You have to establish that you do not have what's called deceleration injuries. Deceleration injuries occur when the energy of the crash is so severe that no safety systems on the planet is going to make a difference. So you have to have orthopedic injuries, and you have to make certain that you don't have deceleration injuries. Number three, you then have to get someone who is absolutely qualified to determine what was the delta V. Now, you deal with speed, and you always want to jack up and say, oh, you know, they were going 95 miles an hour. We don't care about speed. We care about delta V, which is the change in velocity. And the reason we do that is because we know what the human tolerance thresholds are at certain delta Vs. There's a human tolerance threshold for frontal impacts at about 55 miles an hour in the front. in the rear, it's greater than that because you've got your back to the impact, so you can go upwards of 100 G's. The side is a problem. There's no space, so you have to make the side very rigid. So if it's about 27 delta V, you get somebody that's absolutely qualified to do that. If you cannot find a crash test, either a frontal, a side, a rear, then you have to go do a test to absolutely tie down the delta V, because that is the number one thing. We've got to be within the tolerance threshold. Then you want to get a great biomechanical engineer, somebody that knows that combines mechanical engineering and medicine, and they talk about the human tolerances, and they talk about how the safety systems should have worked but did not work, or what the safer alternative designs could have done. And then lastly, you want to make certain that you go and learn as much as you can about physics, mechanical engineering, biomechanical engineering, human factors, and then you've got to start talking about the damages. You've got to get life care planners. You've got to get vocational experts. And if you are not good at one of those things, go team up with somebody that's good. You know, one of my favorite movies growing up was Cool Hand Luke. And I never will forget that line. A man's got to know his limitations. And I know my limitations. I know that I can't do damages worth a tinker's dam. So in the 179 trials, I have never asked a single damages question, because I think I look hypocritical if I go rip somebody's face off and then I go do damages and I'm trying to do something, be nice and everything and compassionate. So I always have somebody do it, but they're better at it. And if you don't want to work hard and if you don't want to spend the money, then you need to do everything I said and then joint venture it with somebody that knows how to do it.
Yeah, and I think the it is an incredible time commitment, because the manufacturers just don't give up their documents. There's lots and lots of fights, compel, and then when you finally get something, you get a huge, huge dump of information that you have to go through and spend hours and hours to find what they really didn't give you and identify all the crap. I remember back when, I'm really dating myself, but back when we were doing paper discovery instead of electronic.
In fact, I was going to say, I bet you got the days where they used to dump 50 boxes, 50 banker's boxes on you.
Yep, and they produced like 20 copies of the same thick, 100-something page study. And between like number 17 and number 18, there was an email that was killer. But had we not gone through, and had we just assumed that it was, and we had to go through them, even though they were the same thing over and over again, to find that one, they hid it in there. It was very intentional. But it's what it took to do it. So it's, an incredible amount of time, and you have to know what you're looking for. There's a huge learning curve. How, if someone wants to learn how to do these cases, I guess one thing you can do is go work for a firm that does them. Any other ways people can try to get this knowledge?
Sure. You go to conferences. Go to the Attorneys Information Exchange Group conferences. They do an excellent job of putting on conferences where they will literally diagnose defects and diagnose causation. You go to Texas Trial Lawyers or any of the state organizations around the country. These trial lawyer organizations do an excellent job of putting on seminars that are nuts and bolts seminars on how to handle various types of cases. You call up somebody that you know's tried cases, and I guarantee you, the vast majority of lawyers that do crashworthiness cases, you can call them up and they will be glad to talk to you. They will give you anything that you need. And if they don't, then they're not a good plaintiff. Then that's not a good plaintiff lawyer to begin with, because we should always be sharing. We've got everybody gunning for us. We've got the defense gunning for us. We got the judges gunning against us. We got to convince 10 out of 12 jurors in most states, nine in some states. There are even some where we only have to do 8. My God, that's a wonderful system there.
Yep.
But you want to, everything's stacked against us, so we need to help each other out. If you talk to a lawyer that won't talk to, that will not assist you, call another one. They're out there.
And I will say that Attorneys Information Exchange Group is a great group. And I remember when I was just getting into these cases, 2001, 2002, I remember, you know, I had a Ford F-150 roof crash case, and then Michael Watts had tried in my county a Ford F-150 roof crash case, and he just says, come on in. He let me get a copy of the trial transcript, all the trial exhibits. It, you know, gave me such a head start. I still had to do a lot of work, and there's a huge learning curve, but just reading how other people had argued them, see what experts they used, see, you know, what documents they used was such a head start. I never could have done that case without having other people's help.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, the thing about it, you're going to develop your own style because of those lawyers. You're going to look at them and say, well, I'm never going to be able to make that kind of argument or that kind of technical argument or that kind of persuasive argument. But guess what? I'm going to take bits and pieces of different lawyers' styles that I have now read or I've observed, and I'm going to become a Frankenstein lawyer, and I'm going to take the best of 10, you know, 9 or 10 or 12 lawyers, and I'm going to make myself a lawyer. And don't try to go imitate Michael, because I mean, nobody, first of all, Michael's the smartest human being I've ever met.
Yeah.
And or be a Tab Turner. You know, great. I mean, these are great trial lawyers that have handled a bunch of these cases. And I've handled a bunch of them. And I, you know, I don't know if anybody's going to replicate my style, but, you know, we don't want you to. But we do want you to at least know what are the things that work in front of a jury and what are the things that don't. And why are we asking all these questions in a deposition that we know we're never going to use at trial? Because we want the defense to be focused on a rabbit trail.
Yep.
That way they go focused on it, and we're going to, and we may only take 10% of what we do in a deposition, and that's where we're going to hammer on them at trial. But we don't want to, you know, that's why I always take long depositions, because I want to keep them on their heels.
Why do you do crash testing in these cases?
We're not required to do crash or sled testing, according to all of the courts of appeals. However, let me tell you, when you do a crash test or when you do a sled test, those judges, the trial judges and the appellate court judges, they look at the case completely different, and they go, wow, this is a serious case, number one. This is a serious lawyer, number two, and this is a serious expert, because they're out there and they have the testing. But more importantly, the jury gets to see it. Instead of you showing photographs of this or that or somebody describing it, when a jury can see the crash testing and the dynamics involved and everything that you put into it, they realize, my God, this is a damned important case. And more importantly, they get to see how it works and how it didn't work. When you take a production vehicle system and then use a safer alternative design system and put them side by side in the same vehicle and run a test with the same forces, I'm telling you, it is powerful.
It is. And it, you know, and the defense treats you different when you do a test too. When I got enough money saved up to start doing crash testing, they flat out admitted to me, like, okay, this is a different case now. And we're talking different numbers for the ones that can settle. And if you can't
settle, it absolutely enhances the settlement value. And, you know, I will tell you, initially in my career, I had a mistaken belief that I am not going to do crash testing because I can never out-test the defense. That is absolutely not true. The manufacturers, they do not out-test me on any of my cases, because they'll do one or two tests maybe. We'll do four or five because, you know, we want the jury to see it's important. But the car manufacturers, they've got 500 or 600 cases pending at a time. And fiscally, they can't do it because their budgets have been cut and streamlined so much that the in-house counsel will not let them do test after test after test.
Well, that's a change.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, I think also as you get experience, you learn, you know, you can't just let I've learned the hard way. You can't just let the expert do whatever they want on the test. They're not going to anticipate all the things the defense is going to come up with. You have to really collaborate with they're still going to tell you, you know, what angle, what, you know, what kind of dummy to use, but you have to start collaborating. You know, you need to start educating them on, What about this? They're going to bring that up. Before we spend $100,000 on this test, let's make sure it's one that's going to, you know, hold up. Whatever the results may be, we can stand behind them.
Well, absolutely. But I will tell you, one of the biggest mistakes that young lawyers make when they start handling their first, you know, 10 crashworthiness cases is they let the experts run and direct the case.
Yep.
Huge, monumental mistake. And they will find that that lawyer will find himself, you know, in $1 million hole in a, of 18 months if they let that happen.
I've been there. Not quite a million, but I've been in
the hole. Hey, we have all had that happen to us, and you learn the hard way.
Just out of curiosity, what is the cost range nowadays to handle one of these cases, let's say through remediation and then through trial?
Well, if it's a front seat collapse case, with a, you know, paralyzed person going to have life care plan, you're going to run three sled tests. And then you're going to have two experts. You're going to have a design expert. You're going to have a biomechanic. You're going to have a life care planner. You're still going to spend, you're going to be $250,000 through trial.
Yeah.
If it's a lack of center mounted airbag case, you need to do two tests, side impacts. You do a test with the production. Then you put in the safer alternative design tests in there. You can get away by doing that with a sled rather than a crash test. You'll be into it for $100,000 only. If you call me up, I'll give you my testing because I just spent $500,000 doing 30 tests of multiple vehicles of every PDOF available so that I could knock out all my cases in a one fell swoop. I'll give those tests to people. And I've already given them away. They're on my website.
And PDOF's principal direction of force. So you basically tested at all kinds of different angles.
Every 9 o'clock, 8 o'clock, 7 o'clock, and then 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock, and 11:30, because, you know, not every case is a perfect T-bone. Sometimes there's an angle in there. So,
You
know, your body's going to move toward the direction of the impact. So we had to run those tests to establish that the Yaris Mazda worked like a champ.
If somebody wants to get a hold of you, either because they want to ask more about, you know, how to do their own case, or if they want to just say, I've got a vehicle, I've got a catastrophically injured person, can you help me figure out whether I have a case? Maybe we can work together. How can they get a hold of you?
Well, my office number is 214-324-9000. My cell phone's 214-704-8312. And I answer it all. It seems like I answer calls all over the country. So, I mean, as long as I'm not asleep, I'll pick up the phone. But I'd be glad to help any of your listeners, point them in the right direction, give them the experts to hire, the experts not to hire, and which is important.
It is.
Yeah, you know, we all think that all experts are created equal. That's not true. You know, the experts that I used to use, I don't use them anymore because, you know, time caught up with them. You know, and, you know, so we've had to develop new experts. And so is the defense. You know, the experts that I guarantee you the defense used to use with you, they're not using them anymore. Or they are winding down their career. And they need to, because they're getting really long in the tooth. Some of these old defense experts are. But I'd be glad to help them in any way I can. I'll give them any testing they want. I'll give them outlines. They can come watch me take a deposition. Or we take everything by Zoom now. I don't need to be in the room with anybody because, you know, I don't think these guys have testified hundreds of times. Now, the new people haven't, but, you know, we'll take one deposition of them and really get them tied down hard.
And we're going to have a link to your website. Your website's incredible. You have so much information, even more about the different types of cases, and then you're generous enough to share all your testing. And so, Todd, thank you for coming on, and thank you for everything you do. And listeners, thank you for listening, and please join us next time on Trial Lawyer Nation.
Thank you for joining us on Trial Lawyer Nation. I hope you enjoyed our show. If you'd like to receive updates, insider information, and more from Trial Lawyer Nation, sign up for our mailing list at triallawyernation.com. You can also visit our episodes page on the website for show notes and direct links to any resources in this or any past episode. To help more attorneys find our podcast, please like, share, and subscribe to our podcast on any of our social media outlets. If you'd like access to exclusive, plaintiff lawyer-only content and live monthly discussions with me, send a request to join the Trial Lawyer Nation Insider Circle Facebook group. Thanks again for tuning in. I look forward to having you with us next time on Trial Lawyer Nation.
Each year, the law firm of Cowan Rodriguez Peacock pays millions of dollars in co-counsel fees to attorneys nationwide on trucking and commercial vehicle cases. If you have an injury case involving death or catastrophic injuries and would like to partner with our firm, please contact us by calling 210-941-1301 to discuss the case in detail and see where we can add value in a partnership. This podcast has been hosted by Michael Cowan and is not intended to, nor does it create, the attorney-client privilege between our host, guest, and any listener for any reason. Content from the podcast is not to be interpreted as legal advice. All thoughts and opinions expressed herein are only those from which they came.